I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
The essence of civilization is that the strong have a duty to protect the weak. Cases where there are serious doubts and questions, the presumption should be in the favor of life.
President Bush, who spoke very briefly this morning about the death of Terri Schiavo, who passed away at 9 a.m. East Coast time as she entered her 14th day without a feeding tube, which was removed despite pleas from her parents and attempts by lawmakers to replace it. A Vatican spokesman had even stronger words, calling Schiavo's death an attack against God. And the Reverend Frank Pavone spoke for Terri's parents.
This is not only a death with all the sadness that brings, this is a killing. And for that, we not only grieve that Terri has passed, but we grieve that our nation has allowed such an atrocity as this, and we pray that it will never happen again.
Terri's parents, Mary and Bob Schindler, and her husband, Michael Schiavo, have not commented. Reporter Kara Buckley writes for the Miami Herald. She's outside the hospice in Pinellas Park, Florida, where Terri Schiavo died today. Kara, can you set the scene for us? What is it like there?
Well, the scene has basically started to disintegrate. Protesters have ripped down almost all of the signs that we've seen all week up against the orange fence that encircles the hospice. They're carrying them away in large garbage bags, large piles of them. There's a mass being held by the Monsignor Thaddeus Mankowski, who's been a spiritual advisor to the family. There's some people who are still here, very upset, emotional, still angry over what happened, and still feeling like a wrong was done, a grievous wrong against Ms. Schiavo and her family.
Oh, Kara, do we know who was at Terri Schiavo's bedside when she died?
We don't know. We have unconfirmed reports that Michael was there. We do know Suzanne and Bobby were asked to leave several moments before she died, and Father Pavone was asked to leave too. Again, it's just unconfirmed that Michael was. We don't know for certain.
You're saying that her brother and sister might have been asked to leave before she died?
No, they were asked to leave. They were asked to leave before she died. We don't know whether that was because they anticipated the death was about to happen or that it was just a routine check on Terri to see how she was doing in her last moments. Mm-hmm. In any event, there's a great deal of acrimony that the family is feeling that they weren't there at her side at the moment she passed away.
But we do understand that both sides did agree to an autopsy. Am I correct on that?
Yes, both sides did agree. This is something that in the last few days that Michael Schiavo and his lawyer, George Filo, said they would do. Clearly what they want to do is do away with any sort of these accusations that Michael is covering something up in ordering her cremation. There was a lot of suspicions out here, a lot of accusations that he had been abusive, that his intent behind ordering her cremation was to cover any mention of abuse. And, of course, the big question is, when they look at her brain, what was the state of her brain? Was her cerebral cortex, in fact, liquefied, as CAT scans have shown?
Well, of course, it's a technical discussion of something that's, still a very emotional, powerful thing for people. And I'm wondering, Kara, never or rarely is a death more predicted, more anticipated. But is there still a sense of this can't have happened?
Absolutely. People arrived. A rabbi from Brooklyn just arrived today. People flew in last night from Wisconsin. They really had hope that this wouldn't happen, that there'd even be divine intervention to save her life. They're crushed that this happened.
Kara, one last question. Where is the body of Terri Schiavo, and is there... I'm sure there's going to be extra security when it's moved.
Well, there's extra security now. Every car is being searched on the way in. There's, the state and as well as local police officers here. As far as we can tell, the body is still there. It's only been a couple of hours. We haven't seen any ambulances leaving. Mind you, there are 70 other patients in there.
Yeah.
So just because an ambulance leaves does not necessarily mean it contains her body. But as far as we know, it's still inside the hospice.
Kara Buckley, reporter for the Miami Herald. Kara, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the death of Terri Schiavo also brings to an end an extraordinary legal battle between her husband, Michael, and her parents, Bob and Mary Schindler. The latest court action came last night when the Supreme Court for the sixth time declined to intervene. This after the 11th Circuit Court in Atlanta also denied the Schindlers' request to reconnect Schiavo's feeding tube. Jonathan Turley, George Washington University law professor, joins us. Jonathan, can you start by telling us about the latest decision from the 11th Circuit Court?
What was interesting of the 11th Circuit decision was that one of the judges, Judge Birch, attached to the decision his own opinion that really went after Congress and the President, suggesting that they had abused their authority and had raised very significant challenges to the fundamental constitutional guarantees of separation of powers.
In fact, I have it in front of me. He said, he wrote, "In resolving the Schiavo controversy, it is my judgment that despite sincere and altruistic motivation, the legislative and executive branches of our government have acted in a manner demonstrably at odds with our Founding Fathers' blueprint for the governance of a free people, our Constitution, because the special legislation passed by Congress and signed by President Bush," and then more quotes, "constitutes legislative dictation of how a federal court should exercise its judicial functions." Who is Judge Birch?
Actually, Judge Birch is considered by many to be either moderate or conservative. He is not considered a member of the left wing on that court. But I think that Judge Birch was speaking for a great number of judges. There was a sense, I think, among judges that Congress was giving the bum's rush to the court, saying, we want you to rule, and we're going to add mountains of political pressure to get you to side with the Schindlers. And the judicial branch pushed back. And in that sense, the system worked. You know, the Madisonian democracy is actually built for bad weather, not good weather. And we saw in this case that you have two branches, the executive and legislative branches, that in my view failed. I mean, they usurped the authority of the courts. They did exceed their authority. But the system still worked because the third branch held the line. And I think that the judge was correct that there was, in Congress and the President, a real mistake of judgment in the intervention of this type of individual case.
Ironically, Judge Birch wrote that to do anything other than what the judges have done would be to act in a manner consistent with the label activist judge, but he and other judges who have ruled against the parents are being called activist judges.
I think that's right, and I think it's unfair. You know, there's a tendency to view any judge who doesn't rule in your favor as some type of activist. Otherwise, how could you blindly ignore the merits of the case? In reality, the judges that have ruled in this case, and we're talking 21 out of 23 federal judges, involve some of the most conservative judges in the country. The legal issues in this case have always been clear, and I think in that sense, Judge Birch did speak for many when he issued that statement.
And just, Jonathan, before we let you go on, what's a very sad or at the very least complicated day for a lot of people? Is this going to go any further in any direction? Will there be any civil action?
I think that there is going to be a legal aftermath to the case. There's a great deal of broken legal china on the ground, and we're going to have to sort through it and to see what legitimate issues were raised. I think that one legitimate issue that was raised by the Schindlers was whether Michael Schiavo should have continued as the guardian after he created a new family and had children with another woman, whether that changed his marital relationship with Terry. I think it's a legitimate question. The great irony is that what Congress did actually undermined the Schindlers, that it effectively poisoned the well for these appeals. And you can see that in Judge Birch's opinion, that because Congress tried to sort of muscle this through the courts, it converted the case from the merits to a constitutional controversy. That ultimately worked heavily against the Schindlers.
Jonathan Turley, law professor at George Washington University. Jonathan, thank you.
Thank you.
To the Middle East now, where a period of relative calm in the Palestinian territories was rattled last night when Palestinian militants attacked the headquarters of President Mahmoud Abbas, also known as Abu Mazen. The 15 or so militants then went on a rampage through the West Bank town of Ramallah. No one was hurt, but the incident comes after a wave of conflicting assessments in recent days by Israeli authorities as to how well the Palestinian Authority is doing in the effort to police militants. In a separate incident last night in Tulkarm, seven armed Palestinians burned down a checkpoint. Zvi Yaheskeli is there. He's a correspondent for Israel's Channel 10 television. And Zvi, first, what can you tell us about last night's attack on the president's Ramallah compound?
Yeah, what happened yesterday in Ramallah, not far from here, from Tulkarm, it's gunmen went out from the center of the city towards the Mukata. This is Abu Mazen's headquarters. And asked him to let them in, because they want to stay there, to return back there. because they know that if the Israeli army will look for them, they will be more secure there. And Abu Mazen just refused to let them go in, and that's why they shoot. But it was a shooting for only 5 minutes. Afterwards, we're going down the street and demolished restaurants and places around the city that belong to Palestinian officials because they were very angry because they saw that the Palestinian Authority supposed to defend them. I think this is the beginning of anarchy here in the West Bank.
And Israel's Defense Minister Shaul Mufaz, who's been critical of the Palestinian leadership in the last couple of weeks, he said that this attack on the compound just illustrates that the Palestinian president has to do much more to crack down on terrorists.
Yeah, I think that Abu Mazen maybe wants to fight those militants, but he can't. Actually, he can't. He can't send his soldiers to fight because there is no support for this kind of act in the Palestinian street.
But on the other hand, as you well know, there are other Israeli leaders who say that this kind of negotiation by Abu Mazen, President Abbas, is working. Israeli Brigadier General Kupawasser recently testified before a Knesset committee. He said that the Palestinian Authority is stopping as many terror attacks as Israel is. First of all, was that surprising news for Israelis to hear?
No, I'm not surprised because I'm covering the Palestinian Authority for many years, and I know that in this period when Abu Mazen is the president, and there is a new mood, a new language in the Palestinian Authority, but the Israeli always are not satisfied. I think that Abu Mazen security services blocked 17 tunnels in Rafah, in the south of Gaza Strip. They arrested. Now, I came from Turkey and I came from a Palestinian prison. I saw three militants of the Islamic Jihad that they are under supervision of Palestinian security services in a Palestinian prison.
Zvi, we're also wondering if some of these conflicting statements are because of confusion on the part of some of the Israelis. As we've heard from some of your colleagues, this is new territory.
I think that that the Israeli, all the Israelis leaders, they're talking in two ways because you can hear in one day Minister Mufaz talking about smuggling of Palestinian officers, smuggling the Strela missiles into Gaza Strip. And one day you can hear another officer, Israeli officer, saying that the Palestinian Authority are still working and we have to give them a time.
Zvi Yehezkeli from Israel's Channel 10. Hold that thought, because when we come back, Zvi is in the West Bank riding along with Palestinian security police. We'll ask, how are they doing? Also, an analyst weighs in. Are the attacks in the Palestinian territories predictable? Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Picking up our conversation with Zvi Yehezkeli, reporter for Israel's Channel 10 TV, about last night's attacks in the Palestinian territories. A group of Palestinian militants shot up the Palestinian president's compound in Ramallah. In neighboring Tulkarm, a handful of militants burned a checkpoint. Zvi, you are in Tulkarm, videotaping a Palestinian security team as they search for those militants. How are they performing their jobs?
I think that they are now rebuilding themselves after 4 years of war, and they really want to begin their work or their operation. But they told me, look, if we know that there is a suicide bomber that wants to cross from area of Tulkarm to Israel, we will stop him. But if the Israeli army will catch our hand and will ask us, where are you going, and won't let us go to the areas around the Tulkarm, we can't stop the next suicide bomber. And just to remind you, the last suicide bomber, just before 1 month, that exploded himself in Tel Aviv in a stage cafe, he came from Tulkarm, exactly the area that I'm now staying in.
So they want more ability to move around, but I'm wondering, do they seem to have the support of the civilians?
Yeah, they got a support from the civilians. The Palestinian people respect them, but the Palestinian people asking from the Palestinian Authority things to give them, freedom of movement and release of prisoners and stuff like this. If the Palestinian Authority won't give them, they won't respect the policemen.
And in your observation, do the Palestinian security people appear ready to arrest their own people? I mean, you said they mentioned that they would stop suicide bombers, but do you think that they were serious about that?
Yeah, they're serious, but they want it to be with rewards. They want to tell to the Israelis that if you want us to arrest Jihad Islami and Hamas, please give us things. This is the formula. This is what they're asking. And I think this is that's why Israelis have to pay attention.
Zvi Yeheskeli is a correspondent for Israel's Channel 10 TV. Zvi, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Well, we turn now to Melissa Maley. She's a former CIA field officer, now works with a security consulting firm in Washington, D.C. Melissa, we just heard an Israeli reporter describe the attack on the Palestinian president's compound last night as anarchy. Would you agree?
I wouldn't characterize it as anarchy, but what we're beginning to see here is the reaction to the Palestinian Authority exerting itself and making a showing on the street. And the militants don't like what they're seeing, and they're pushing back. These militants in particular in Ramallah, they had wanted to take safe haven in the compound of the president. And unlike Arafat, the previous president, Mahmoud Abbas denied them that safe haven because the rules of the game are different now, and that was his way of showing it. So we're having pushback, but I think it's very important to understand that the Palestinians on the street do not want to see anarchy. They don't want to see it any more than they want to see civil war. What they want to see is law and order, and ultimately they will side with Abu Mazen on that, Mahmoud Abbas on that front. And so, but I think this is an important indicator that that the Palestinian Authority is moving forward with its program. They're not adjusting and falling back. That doesn't mean they're going to go out and arrest everybody. That's not part of their program, as our Israeli commentator just said. But they will talk to them and say, this is the agenda, we're going to negotiate, we're going to put away our arms, and everybody's got to get with the program, and specifically he has to talk to the people in his own political party.
Well, what is the danger for the Palestinian president? We saw an attack on his compound and a rampage through the streets of a city, but how much worse could it get? I mean, what are his fears and concerns?
I think his real concern would be that there a Palestinian civil war would evolve, and that would be with the Palestinian Authority standing up and saying this is the direction of the country, and having the civilians split on the topic, and so that he wants to avoid. And that's why he's focusing on the consensus. And through that consensus, it's very important. He hopes to be able to build political will and capabilities at the same time, so that when somebody does go out and shoots up the Mukata, which is an illegal act, then they will have the capability and the pact with the people that that's an illegal act, these people may be arrested.
What do you make of the conflicting statements coming out of Israel? As we mentioned, Israeli General Cooper Wasser saying that the Palestinian security forces have been able to thwart just as many attacks as Israeli forces have, something that surprised a lot of Israelis. On the other hand, Defense Minister Shaul Mufaz saying that there's a huge gap between what President Abbas says he's going to do and what's actually being done. He's been very critical.
Well, first of all, on the Cooper Wasser statement, this is very significant because Major General Cooper Wasser, he's the head of military intelligence, he is a hardliner, and he seldom, if ever, has anything positive to say about Palestinian security capabilities or political will. But he's acknowledging that they are taking measures on the ground and stopping terror attacks. That's very significant, and just factually, and also that fact that it's coming from him, very influential man within the Israeli security establishment. At the same time, you have Mufaz voicing a fear. This is not a fear of just today that Palestinians are going to bring into the Gaza Strip heavy weaponry that will be used against Israel. This is a fear that was voiced many times during the Oslo period, during the 1990s, and accusations indeed were voiced, but these weapons never materialized. Since they never materialized, my assessment would be they didn't exist, at least in the 1990s. Whether it's true now or not, it's important because it shows how nervous nervous the military establishes over the thought of evacuating or losing control of that border between Egypt and the Gaza Strip. And then if they lose that control over that border and weapons are brought in, then they have lost in their outer perimeter of defense.
These are nerve-wracking times.
Very much so, and I think that the Israeli population are very much split over a lot of different issues. You've got the split between the settlers, the expansionist and the consolidationist, I would say, within Israeli society. And those who want to see the hope in the moment are seeing it, but those who don't like this outcome are highlighting the fears.
Melissa Maley is a security consultant based in Washington, D.C., also author of Denial and Deception, an insider's view of the CIA from Iran-Contra to 9/11. Melissa, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, the hybrid car craze. Well, at last, we'll look at how automakers are turning green cars into luxury vehicles. Also, China may leapfrog over a gas culture right into cars that run on hydrogen. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now with this news summary. In a scathing report, a presidential commission said today that U.S. spy agencies were, quote, dead wrong in most of the judgments made about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and that much of the intelligence gathered by the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the National Security Agency, and others about Iraq was either worthless or misleading. The commission also had harsh words about the current state of intelligence, saying that the U.S. knows disturbingly little about nuclear threats from its adversaries. President Bush responded to the report today, saying that he shares the commission's central conclusion that the intelligence community needs fundamental change.
Our collection and analysis of intelligence will never be perfect, but in an age where our margin for error is getting smaller, in an age in which we are at war, the consequences of underestimating a threat could be tens of thousands of innocent lives. And my administration will continue to make intelligence reforms that will allow us to identify threats before they fully emerge so we can take effective action to protect the American people.
Among the changes the commission is recommending, broader powers for John Negroponte, the president's nominee to become the Director of National Intelligence, a new position. Also, full integration of the FBI into the intelligence community and higher expectations of the intelligence community. The commission says analysts must be urged to explain what they don't know, and agencies must explain why they don't have better information. This week, the Supreme Court heard arguments in the case known as MGM versus Grokster. Former Solicitor General Theodore Olson argued for MGM and several other petitioners that file-sharing enterprises, such as Grokster, are stealing intellectual property, that the technology was created for the purpose of taking something for nothing. Charles Baker was one of the lawyers on the other side. He represents Streamcast, one of Grokster's co-defendants in the case, and he says it's important to look back to a Supreme Court decision from 1984, the decision in the case Sony versus Universal City Studios. And Charles, can you explain?
Sony Betamax, VCR, first one to hit the market. There had been nothing like this before, and what it allowed people to do was to copy TV programs. Mm-hmm. And TV programs are copyrighted material. They're like movies.
But actually, in that case, as you have written, the central holding is that the one who distributes that technology to the public can't be held responsible if that technology is used for illegal purposes, because, in fact, Sony tapes were used in television production. They were used for perfectly legal purposes. People went out with cameras and recorded images and, for instance, cut news stories. But in the case of Grokster and other online services, there doesn't seem to be any other use for them.
There's two things going on here. Number one, our product is being used along with everyone else's product in this area to trade files that are not copyrighted. I will agree that the majority use right now is for using and trading music, okay, copyrighted music. Mm-hmm. But there are millions and millions of files traded every day that are not copyrighted over these networks. And that's what we're saying, is that don't kill this thing right now. It's in its infancy stages, and if you do this, then you're going to possibly just put a freeze on all technological advances. And, you know, this standard has done well for us for the last 20 years.
Well, the other side is also arguing that not only do the Grokster-type enterprises violate the rights of artists, but they convert hundreds of thousands of our citizens, especially children, into thieves.
Well, we supply a product, okay? And it's like other products out there that other manufacturers do that have both good things and bad things. And I hate to use this analogy, but the gun manufacturers are similar to along this. I mean, people have used this analogy. There's also the analogy of cigarette papers, okay, of Zig-Zag. There's an example there that people well know that product can be used to do illegal things. And so why should the manufacturer be held responsible if an individual makes the conscious decision of performing the illegal act or wrongful act with that product?
When you mention guns, do you mean as in guns don't kill people, people do?
That's right, yes. Yeah. I mean, you know, people use guns to defend themselves, rightfully so. And also there's other, you know, guns that you use it to go hunting, which is legal.
Charles, what were some of the things the justices asked you?
I remember more pointedly what they asked the other side. For example, they asked, what would be the standard? What would be the standard that you would propose? And they really couldn't give an answer to it.
Meaning what?
I mean, the justices were asking, all right, you want to change the Sony Betamax standard. Well, what's a bright line test that we can tell the lower courts now when we should hold someone responsible? Should we hold it when there's 50% of infringement that's happening on these systems, or is it 70%, or is it 80%, or is it 30%? You know, where's the bright line test here? And they couldn't articulate a standard.
Because, again, Sony had claimed in that case that it was also used for a huge percentage of legal purposes.
Yes.
Give me an example of a question a justice might have asked you and your side about your position.
Well, one of the positions was that if they were to change the standard, how would it affect our client, my client, and other technology innovators out there? And is there really going to be this so-called chill, in fact, if they were to change the rule? And how would it impact technology in the United States overall? So they are focusing on the big picture here.
In other words, not how it works, but whether
there were really no questions. That's one thing that I guess I was a little bit surprised about, but there were no questions about how the technology works.
Yeah,
that leads me to believe they have a very good grasp of what happens here.
It was more about what will it mean for copyrights and for infringement down the road.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And also, how can we, you know, should we somehow be treated differently because there have been accusations made that we actively induced people to download music? Mm-hmm. Okay, and they're saying, well, because there's accusations that your clients actively promoted the downloading of music, then you ought to be held to a different standard. And we disputed that because there was no real evidence showing that we went out and told people, and we didn't. There's nothing in the record that says, you know, that my client promoted on its website, you know, download music, you know, this is the greatest thing in the world, da 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 da. We never did that. And we feel strongly if we're going to go back and have to try that issue, we'll win. But I do think that if people out there are out there actively promoting and inducing copyright infringement, that they will be held responsible for it.
In other words, the websites that use your product who might be encouraging people to download should be held responsible, not your client, which
That's
makes
right.
the technology.
See, once my client, once they distribute the software, they don't have any contact with the customer. They have advertisers that send the people information about advertisements and things like that. But we don't have any servers, any other computers that are hooked up to them. We have no idea what's going on with the product. We just sell it, and that's it.
Charles Baker is with the law firm Porter & Hedges in Houston, Texas. He represents Streamcast, one of the defendants in MGM versus Grokster, now before the Supreme Court. Still to come, a new memoir enters difficult terrain as a wife grapples with her decision to stand by as her husband takes his own life. You're listening to Here and Now. His critics say he's arrogant, abrasive, he's been a failure in the NBA. But few would argue that Rick Pitino has been one of the most charismatic and successful college basketball coaches of the past two decades. In the 90s, Pitino took a tattered program at the University of Kentucky and turned it into a national champion. In 2001, he replaced longtime coach Denny Crum at Kentucky's cross-state rival Louisville, and since then has undergone a personal transformation. Only a Game's Bill Littlefield talked to Jerry Brewer, a columnist for the Louisville Courier-Journal. This weekend, Pitino takes his third school to the Final Four, and Bill asked Jerry if Pitino takes any credit for that.
He takes less credit than he's ever taken. You know, I think he's just enjoying this ride. Life has changed him a little bit. I think failing with the Boston Celtics helped change him. He lost his brother-in-law and best friend, Billy Minardi, in the September 11th terrorist attacks, and that definitely changed him. As he's gotten older, he's starting to mellow out a little bit more, and he just has a totally different perspective about this. You know, it really seems like he's smelling the roses on this run, where before he would just be in the back in the dark room watching film trying to enhance his greatness.
That's an interesting way to put it, enhance his greatness. One of the consequences of Rick Pitino's attitude in the past has been that his players have certainly heard more four-letter words, perhaps, than they are accustomed to hearing anywhere but the basketball court. Is that still the case with the newer, kinder, gentler Rick Pitino?
You know, Rick Pitino still has a very creative vocabulary. That's not going to change. You know, it's interesting, though, that his players actually get to talk back, and there's more conversation in huddles now than you've ever seen in a Rick Pitino huddle before.
As you mentioned, Rick Pitino's tenure as the coach of the Boston Celtics was not entirely successful. He hasn't been a great NBA coach. Is Pitino's coaching style simply better suited to the college game, and if so, why?
Pitino has this way of making you feel like you can run through a wall for him. And in pro basketball, there's a different motivation there. The guys have arrived, where in college, his greatest motivation is, you know, if you just listen to me and you bust your butt for me, you know, I can get you to where you want to be.
When Rick Pitino took the job in Louisville, people in Kentucky were shocked. The Kentucky basketball world was really rocked. What did and what do Kentuckians feel about Pitino having coached two bitter rivals?
Totally flip-flop now. It's amazing how people who used to hate Rick Pitino in Louisville absolutely adore him now. And people who thought that Pitino was the greatest coach ever in Lexington absolutely hate him. It's pretty crazy. He turned the state upside down. And I tell you what, you know, a lot of Kentucky fans miss him right now.
Well, I'm sure they do. What does Pitino himself feel about having coached so successfully with the University of Kentucky and now being so successful at Louisville? Is there any kind of disconnect for him personally?
Well, he's a Louisville guy now. He's not a Kentucky guy anymore. He just hopes that fans appreciate what he did at Kentucky, and I think he believes that the true fans still appreciate him and miss him. You know, it was a tough decision for him to do that, considering what he had done at Kentucky. He was all ready to take this Michigan job. He actually accepted it.
Mm-hmm.
And then his wife changed his mind and told him, we need to be in Louisville, and this is what you want to do, and don't worry about the backlash. You know, in general, he's just having a good time being in Louisville. It's a bigger city than Lexington is. You know, he kind of gets to be himself a little bit more here. At Kentucky and Lexington, fans would go and pick up blades of grass in his yard because Rick Pitino had walked on this yard. You know, they're not really doing that here in the Ville.
Well, what do they do if his Cardinals beat Illinois on Saturday and then win the whole tournament? Are they building statues to him just in Louisville or all over Kentucky?
It'll just be in Louisville, you know. Kentucky fans will absolutely hate him. You know, if he gets this done here in Louisville, he will go down as beloved as Denny Crum because, you know, Crum did it for 30 years, but for Pitino to bring it back and to bring the excitement back, you know, it's just truly been a remarkable thing. And we've seen the vulnerable side of Rick Pitino, and I think a lot of people feel like he's a different man today. It's a little bit more fun to see him win now than it used to be.
Columnist Jerry Brewer talking with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Laura and Guy Waterman were an iconic couple, friends and admirers making pilgrimages to their rustic Vermont homestead. The Watermans were also revered rock climbers and environmental activists. They were well-educated. He had memorized all of Milton's Paradise Lost. Her father was a scholar of Emily Dickinson. And in their 60s, they were still in love. But on a February day in the year 2000, Guy Waterman climbed to the summit of Mount Lafayette in New Hampshire's White Mountains and sat down to wait to freeze to death. What's more, his wife Laura knew what he was doing, and she did nothing to stop it. Their lives together and his death are chronicled in her new book, Losing the Garden, The Story of a Marriage, and Laura Waterman joins us now. Laura, who else was Guy in addition to being a beloved environmentalist?
He was a jazz pianist in Washington at 17. When he was in his very early 20s, he was on the floor of the Senate, a Senate aide.
It was so easy to see how you could fall in love with him. He was so charismatic and attractive. But also, I'm wondering, at the time, did you question his meticulousness, his accounting of every detail in baseball, memorizing Milton, the 3x5 cards he carried around? Did you ever realize then that, you know, in his trying to control the world, he might have been trying to keep something at bay?
No. He made his controlling a game. For instance, the blueberries. It sounds totally ridiculous that we counted individual berries on each of our bushes, but it was a game for us and for everyone who came and helped pick blueberries with us. It wasn't until after I knew that he wanted to take his own life, which was 18 months before he did, that I began to understand the role that his 3x5 cards made and his need to, he was really controlling his own life.
And by extension, yours, in some ways. Which,
yes, that's true.
Well, and I'm thinking of that day that he came back from a hike, and this is the day that you found out what his plan was, when he told you that he almost jumped off a cliff. You put your reaction in italics in the book, and you know, you're thinking, oh my God, did I just hear this right? And what you're saying is something like, well, I'm glad you didn't step in the mud, or I'm paraphrasing, I can't remember. You know, whereas someone else reading that might say, why didn't you say, quick, let's go get help, and you know, stop it. How could you think of ending this beautiful life we have? You didn't do that.
Well, when he came back and told me that he wanted to take his own life, he said it with such conviction. It didn't even really occur to me that I would be able to stop him.
He had children who died, one also climbing up a mountain and never coming back down. He had terrible rages that he only let you see.
Yes. I think that, you know, growing up with a fairly alcoholic family, especially my father, I was used to those suppressed rages. So although Guy's reactions were very painful to me, it didn't feel unfamiliar. And in a sense, I acted toward Guy in the same way that I acted toward my father, which was basically not to question how he was acting.
And try to smooth things over and not make things worse.
Exactly.
And Guy, your husband, was also an alcoholic.
Yes, that's right.
Well, then we come to 18 months of keeping this secret that you both knew that he was going to do this. How did you keep that secret?
In a way, it wasn't very hard. And I think, again, it connects back to what I just said. I mean, with my own family, that I mean, people who grow up in alcoholic families are used to keeping secrets.
As you did the garden, chopped the wood, it felt as if he really was trying to prepare you, make sure that your life was in order when he left.
He was.
But everything was for the last time.
That's true. And at the beginning of the 18 months, I mean, I was just so glad that I was going to have 18 more months of being with Guy and on our homestead that, in a sense, it seemed like a beginning of a new life almost. Mm. When I began writing my memoir, I understood that he really had unfinished business. I mean, he had to come back because he couldn't leave me unprepared. But the tasks that we were doing, and often for the last time, it was very bittersweet. We were really saying goodbye to the life together.
What were some of the things you did?
Well, our sugaring. Sugaring was the time of year that we enjoyed most. When we were working at the sugar shed together, I was very aware of, I really had a heightened awareness of sawing the wood and noticing how the sun slanted through a particular hemlock that was close to the sugar shed, or watching the light change on the snow or the shadows lengthen. Mm.
Given that, what did he say to you? What was so compelling that he wanted to leave such a beautiful place? And you?
Well, he wanted to get out of his life. I mean, he was depressed, which was the word that we never used.
Because how could he be depressed? He was up at 4 o'clock every morning doing all sorts of writing and chopping and making notes and 3x5 cards and organizing.
Exactly. I mean, he didn't appear depressed to me.
He also expressed to you that he didn't like the fact that he was getting older.
That's true.
But did that strike you as selfish because he was going to get older with you?
Yes. I could feel resentful or even have spurts of anger that he was choosing to leave. But I could also see that how unhappy he was.
So how, Laura Waterman, should we view Guy Waterman?
That is really a tough question. I think he was a very human person who had this great zest for life, but yet was tortured and wanted people only to see the outside of himself, the part that was joyful.
Yeah.
I think he felt he made some very grave mistakes in his life with his sons, and he couldn't forgive himself for those things.
And how are you doing? The book is you doing what you say you couldn't do at the time, which was pulling apart the me, you, from the we. Right.
Well, I feel that I've regained my life or my spirit. That book was an amazing journey for me. And when I started it, I didn't see the journey that lay ahead at all.
And how would you explain that journey?
It was an investigation into, why? How did I do this? I mean, how could I just stand there and watch my husband go out the door to commit suicide? I mean, how could that happen? I mean, that was the question that I eventually ended up asking myself after 4 or 5 drafts.
As you've said, one of the answers was in your own family background, growing up with an alcoholic father, and the other was maybe you knew you couldn't stop him.
I couldn't. Most people that knew Guy well would have said that also. We don't have control over other people. We do pretty much what we want to do.
Laura Waterman's book is Losing the Garden, the story of a marriage. It tells the story of her life and of Guy Waterman's death, his suicide. Laura, thanks so much for speaking to us about it.
Thank you very much, Robin.
For more on environmental projects in memory of Guy Waterman, go to our website, here-now.org. Guy Waterman planned everything in his last 18 months, including having friends record him playing music that they later realized was for his funeral. We leave you with a portion of Haydn's Opus 54 in G major. It's a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.